Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, July 22nd, 1998. In the Creekside room this evening is Roberta Bondi. Session number is 98-3 and is titled Sayings from the Desert, Humility. Let's listen in.
This is Roberta Bondi. This is our third session on humility. Now, how many people do we have that were not here either last night or the night
before? Teaching at Holden Village.
Reputation is
starting over again every time with who the people are that we're talking about. But I'm trying to think of new ways to introduce them. But tonight I think I'll use the heavy hand approach. I haven't used the heavy hand approach yet, so we'll try it. The people that we're talking about this week and their contribution to modern spirituality are the folk who were known as the founders of monasticism in ancient Egypt and ancient Christian Egypt. And we're talking about people from the 4th through the 6th century. Now, these are interesting people for all sorts of different reasons, but one reason they're interesting is that they were a bunch of free spirits. They have approaches to things that are quite unexpected, I think, in terms of a lot of modern folk. And I have some solutions to some theological and spiritual problems, I think, that we wrestle with today. And one of them is the issue of humility. Now, before we talk about humility, let me just say a word or two more about to kind of situate us with these interesting people. These people who were the founders of very early monasticism, who were also rather different from the folk that we normally think of as monastics. Most people have an image of medieval monasticism, monasticism. But these were people we're looking at lived in rather small communities. We will not be talking about St. Benedict, but if we were, St. Benedict's early communities only had about 12 people in them, and that would be not an unusual size for a small monastic community. We're talking about small groups of people here who are working out together what they are trying to do. Is what they're about is a radical living out of the goal of love of God and love of neighbor. As far as they're concerned, what Jesus calls us to in the gospel is to love the Lord our God with all our heart, soul, strength, mind, and our neighbor as ourselves. And when they talked about it, they connected that passage with the story of the rich young ruler, where the rich young ruler comes up to Jesus and says, what do I need to do to be perfect? And they understand the goal of the Christian life is perfection in love with God and love with neighbor. One of the things that we've been saying the rest of the week is that when they're talking about perfection, they're not talking about a kind of static state where, you know, if you do all the right things, you get there and you look around and say, thank God I'm here, not and think about something else. they're thinking of something that is always moving. Gregory of Nyssa in the 4th century talks about our growth in the love of God and our movement toward Christian perfection, something that begins in this life and continues through eternity because it's movement into God who is unlimited. So when you hear this language of perfection, it's a fluid kind of language, and it's not, there's no rigidity to it. Perfectionism, there's a big difference between perfectionism and the kind of perfection that they're talking about. We've all known perfectionists, you know. Maybe we even are, God forbid, ourselves perfectionists. You know, and we suffer from perfectionism, which is the belief that we got to do everything right. Or something terrible that might happen. You know, and it can have all sorts of interesting manifestations. One way that people are often perfectionists is to think, I've got to do everything perfectly in order to earn my right to breathe the air. that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about the conversion of the whole self. That's the way to think of it. The conversion not just of the heart or of the head or of the commitments or the emotions, but the conversion of the whole self to love. That's what their goal is. Now, last night we talked about the advantages of that kind of approach to things. And one of the advantages in terms of understanding love in these terms as the goal of the Christian life instead of the beginning of the Christian life. See, we talked about the fact that for many, many folks, maybe most of us, we kind of take it for granted that when you become Christian, you love everybody. You can tell, you know, they're Christian by their love. By their love. So, we decide we're Christians. We're called to it. And we know that we have an experience of God. And we're quite certain that that's what we want. And then we assume that, well, then we're supposed to love everybody. Well, what we discover quickly is what John Wesley, the blessed founder of Methodism, he said, we think that sin is dead, but we quickly learn that it is only stunned. Wesley was a man totally without sense of humor, so I don't think he even meant that to be funny. It just makes it all the funnier. But when we put that burden on ourselves of expecting to love neighbor and God from the first day of Christians, we finally can't do it, then we're either tempted to re-describe our non-love in terms of, say, well, this doesn't look like love, but it actually is. You know, still, you know, I'm only hitting you because I love you, sort of. Or we just get demoralized and say, well, I must not be a Christian after all. And then we say in our churches, well, I sure don't want anybody to know about the kinds of problems I'm having with my family or with my kids or my job, because Christians don't do that. See? So having love as the goal of the Christian life and saying that the whole point of the life of a Christian is to grow into this love, to grow into this conversion, this takes a huge burden off of us. You know, this is a kind of monastic, ancient monastic version of simultaneously justified and ascended. Well, of course, we're already in the love of Christ, but we have to learn how to love. And we have to learn both how to love human beings, and we have to learn to love God also. Now, tomorrow, or Friday, we're going to talk about the way they speak of the things that get in the way of love, which they call the passions. Don't get confused and think that you already know what the passions are, because they use that word in a different sense in the way we normally speak of it. But we're going to talk about that on Friday. Now, what they also believe is that nobody just sort of aimlessly shifts around and gets the love without doing some pretty hard work at it. And one thing about working at it is you've got to know where you're moving. Now, I've got someplace in this book. This is the book that I'm working out of, by the way, To Love as God Loves. It's in the bookstore. And if you're interested, I'm donating this one to the auction, To Pray and To Love, because I forgot which book I said that I'm going to be teaching out of, and so I brought a copy of this one. So if you want to bid on this is the only one in Holden Village, and it's the one we're not using. But it has a lot of the material. Okay, now I'm going to find Anthony, who's one of the great founders of Gnosticism, and in fact, he is the one whose name is associated with the founding of Gnosticism. And Anthony once said, whoever hammers a lump of iron first decides what he is to make of it, a scythe, a sword, or an axe. Even so, we ought to make up our minds what kind of virtue we want to forge, or we labor in vain. Now, I find that terribly helpful. I think that one of the problems that we sometimes have as modern Christians is that we do want to embrace the notion of love as the goal of Christian life. We sort of see that, but we don't talk about what it takes to get there. You know, what do we need in order, what are the tools of love? Now, they spoke in the ancient desert in terms of the virtues. But again, don't understand virtues as sorts of rigid patterns of behavior to adopt, but rather attitudes of heart and dispositions that make love possible. So the virtues are essential. So Anthony is saying, we've got to pick out what it is we need to move toward if we are going to use that as a tool to grow into love. Now, one conviction they had in the desert, which I find very helpful, is that we're going to, most of us, we're going to have a whole variety of virtues that we need to work toward. And I'll give you an example, sort of thing I'm thinking of. I had a student once, in the class that I teach on this material, in the seminary, I always make prayer a requirement of the course, that we spend the first 3 weeks setting up a discipline of daily prayer, which I try to model on the ancient monastics prayer, which is basically the Psalms. But then I have them turn in what I call prayer reports during the semester, which is not, you know, it's just write down on a piece of paper how this is going. And this one woman who was in the class turned in a prayer report one time, and she was so happy because she hadn't had her morning prayer until 11 o'clock that morning. And for her, this was a big deal because she was very obsessive and compulsive. You know, she decided she was going to have her prayer at 8 o'clock every morning. By God, she was going to have it not at 5 after 8 or 10 till 8. She was having it at 8. And one of the virtues she had to work on was loosening up so that the rules that she set for herself in life weren't always getting in the way of the love she was trying to express. Now, there's a great story in the sayings about, Abba is the name of the teacher in these little communities. Amma is the male, is the female teacher, it means mother, and Abba is the male teacher, it means father. One of the Abbas, one of the stories, it talks about an Abba who was trying to help a kind of disciple who was very much like my student Jan deal with his own rigidity. And so what he did was he set the disciple to go around in the village, the whole monastic village, and steal from all the brothers during the daytime. This was a sort of a loosening up exercise. But it was very hard on the Abba because the Abba had to stay up all night putting everything back. So the virtues are going to be different depending on who you are. What your sort of weakness is, that's where you're going to be dealing with, you know, you're going to be developing the virtues that deal with your vulnerability to the things that keep you from love. Now, there's one virtue, actually there are more than one virtue, but one virtue in particular that was one that was regarded as important by everybody. And no matter what your disposition was, this was one everybody had to work on. And that was humility. Now, humility is a tough topic for most modern people because of our misunderstandings of it. For a good number of people, for many women particularly, but other minorities, though of course let me point out that women are not minority, not actually a minority, there are lots of us. that humility is understood as equivalent to being a doormat. We'll call it by its right name. Humility means being a doormat. And women, when I was growing up, particularly in the 40s and 50s, in churches where humility was our special word. And so that if you heard the expression, well, she's nothing but a good Christian woman, you knew what that meant. It also often came parallel. Yes, it would be answered when she's nothing but a good Christian woman. Yes, she's just completely selfless. She's just a selfless Christian woman. Where humility was associated with, in people's minds, with being selfless, and that it was a good thing to be selfless if you were a woman, because you were so busy worrying about everybody else and doing the work in the church, washing the dishes and that sort of thing, that you had no concern for yourself whatsoever. Yeah. How many people grew up with that sort of notion of humility?
Oh, yeah.
How many people did not grow up with that sort of notion? How many people grew up with no notion of humility? How many grew up with an alternative vision? Well, this notion of selflessness, I think, is not quite as prevalent as it used to be, but it's still a tricky business. And it was often associated with a kind of false self-sacrifice. Now, I want to distinguish real self-sacrifice, which is a real thing and a necessary thing and a good thing for Christians, with false self-sacrifice. I will give you an example of false self-sacrifice. There you sit with your spouse, and you're looking at this plate, and on this plate is one brownie. And you say, you take the brownie, honey. It's all right. And she takes the brownie. And you think to yourself, I will determine what movie we go to later. Your sacrifice has put you into a position of moral superiority that gives you power over the other person. Now, that's not what we're talking about. That is not real humility. That is false humility. Okay. Now, sometimes humility is also associated with feeling guilty. Now, I don't know about the rest of you. You know, this is a weird part of the world, the western, northwest United States. It is like being in a foreign country for me. So I don't know whether feeling guilty is a sport out here. But it is a major sport in the South. Again, it is particularly played by women, but who are mothers. But it is also played by other folks too, especially those in ministry. And what it goes like, the sort of pattern of play is something happens that you didn't necessarily intend to happen, or something doesn't happen that you did intend to happen, and it may be like a house burns down at the three blocks away. And you think to yourself, oh, if only I'd gone over there at 6 o'clock and someone had answered the door, then maybe they would have caught the fire and the house wouldn't have burned down. You don't even know these people. Okay, and so then you feel guilty. And
that's psychotic guilt.
And it's a sort of game in which feeling guilty takes the place of actually doing anything about it. But you feel like you're somehow or other in the back of your mind, you have the feeling that if you're going to be a good person, you're supposed to suffer and feel responsible when bad things happen. One of the signs of the difference between feeling guilty and acknowledging your guilt and repenting of it is feeling guilty produces a feeling of helplessness. Feeling guilty really will take the place of action. Recognizing that you're guilty and repenting results in doing something. But in the South, as we play this game, you know, a good person feels guilty a lot of the time. They may not do anything, but they feel guilty. Now, and then they associate that also with humility. So that it sort of comes full circle around, and so that what you get is humility equals low self-esteem. You know, and if you play this guilt thing right, and you do several of those things, you can manage to have low self-esteem and be humble in those terms. Now, that is not what we're talking about here. Okay, so the next question probably is, what are we talking about? Okay, now, humility, as the ancient monastic writers speak of it and think of it, is acknowledging to ourselves, as clearly as we can, the fact that we are, every one of us, vulnerable and dependent on God. That it results, humility has something to do with taking a clear-eyed view of the way things are and saying, yes, that's the way things are. And that it's not just me, but that all of us are vulnerable in those particular ways. Now, that's a sort of basic kind of approach to humility. Now, let's look at how that plays out, you know, the sort of the elements in it. The first thing about this that results from humility, and also this is interesting because the way the virtues develop is they both are the starting point and the end point of the way you move. So one of the things that results from humility, but also produces humility, is our understanding that what we need to do is to give up our heroic self-image. That what we have to do is give up the idea that what a Christian is called to is something heroic. Now, that seems odd when you think of these people who just sort of gave up everything. It was like they went out and lived these radical lives in the Egyptian desert. But they were working from the same assumption that I think that we can really benefit from, which is that what trips us up is not that we aim too low, but that we consistently aim too high. And we think unless we can do something in heroic proportions, there's no point in doing it at all. Now, this is really, really fundamental that we start from the assumption that we better allow for our own needs. Now, in the life of St. Anthony, which is a 4th century text written by Athanasius, the Archbishop of Alexandria, but someone who also knew Anthony, Anthony preaches a sermon in the middle of that. Now, whether that sermon is actually written by Anthony or written by Athanasius doesn't really make too much difference because it illustrates the same point either way. But Anthony preaches the sermon in this life, and in it he has advice to all sorts of people, but one of the groups of people is to disciples who are just starting out. And he warns them that that one of their big demonic temptations, this is the temptation of the demons, that what the demons tempt the young monks to is to praying all the time. So that they pray in the daytime and they go to bed, and as soon as they lie down, the demons say, you haven't done enough, get up and pray some more. Now, it's the demons that are doing this. And they do this, and then they poor little suckers get up and they pray. And, you know, and they go back to bed, and the demons say, you haven't prayed enough, and they get up some more. And they do this for, you know, a while, a few weeks, whatever it is, until they just get worn out and utterly demoralized, and they quit the monastic. Now, in the form that one takes, that I see it in consistently in my students, is this is another great contribution of John Wesley, our Methodist founder. As I mentioned before, for those of you who were here last night, Wesley was an obsessive compulsive who got up at 4 o'clock every morning to read his New Testament in Greek and then to have his prayers for those 2 hours between 4 and 6. And so every year we have a few poor, suffering, earnest students who will come into my office at one point and say, Roberta, I'm thinking about dropping out of seminary. Usually, all I have to do is say that, and I can supply the whole rest of the stuff. But because I like to be pastoral and everything, I don't write. I said, well, what seems to be the trouble? And, well, I was reading John Wesley for such and such a class, and then I know. John Wesley got up at 4 every day for his prayer, so I decided that I should, if he could do that at 4, I ought to be able to get up at 6 and spend an hour with my prayers every morning. And, that's not much compared to what Wesley did. But surely, if I'm going to be a pastor, I would be able to do this. And I said, yeah, what happens? You know, as though I didn't know. This was great for 2 weeks, and then, our baby got sick, and the baby was up throwing up all night, and I didn't get any sleep, and I just couldn't get up the next morning for my prayers, and I felt terrible about it, but, the next night I went to sleep and I got up for 2 or 3 more days. But then, then the cat caught what the baby had. And I was up with the cat throwing up all night. I couldn't get up the next morning. And it seems like just one thing after another, and I just can't get to my prayers. And I don't have any other explanation except I just must not be a Christian. Surely, I know I'm not called to the ministry, so I can't even do that. So then I say, well, tell me what else you're doing. Are you married? Obviously, yes, because of the baby and the cat. Do you have any other job? Yes, working 30 hours a week. Are you commuting? Yes. Well, I do drive 2.5 hours a day to school. And I said, well, don't you think maybe it's unreasonable that you should have set this goal for yourself? There's no physical way you can do this. And so then it's, well, but John Wesley, blah, 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 blah. And I say, well, what I have learned from my own monastic teachers is whatever you think you should do in the way of prayer, what you should actually try is half of that. And sometimes, maybe you should even cut back by 3/4. 15 minutes is a big commitment to do where you are in your life. Make a commitment to 15 minutes. And if that works, then add 5 minutes. See? It works. But set yourself a goal that is actually reachable. And don't say, unless I can meet this heroic goal, there's no point. See, that's the trick. That's the trick, is unless I can do this, there's no point in doing it. Now, this is really, really fundamental to their notion of humility. And folks, if you have trouble with perfectionism, this advice is for you. If you really understand this one, it will take the pressure off. It'll take the internal pressure off. Now, let me put it in a way maybe that makes it easier to get a hold of if you're suffering from perfectionism. It may be your discipline that you need to adopt to say, I always want to set more goals than I can actually reach. My discipline is to remember that I'm a human being and that I'm vulnerable and limited. And I need to let go of this heroic self-image and be a human being among limited human beings. And if you can think of it as a discipline, you will not think of it as just being lazy or not earning your keep as you ought to be, or whatever it is, but actually think of it as a discipline. And this can be a very tough one, but it is absolutely, I think, crucial. Now, let me read you another saying that is wonderful with respect to this. We talked about that in terms of prayer. A disciple once asked Abba Pinon, whose sayings make up a large bulk of the sayings of the Fathers, one of his disciples clearly must have asked him, what does it mean in Scripture when Scripture says that you should lay down your life for your neighbor? Now, obviously, this sounds like a heroic task. I am to lay down my life for my neighbor. you know, self-sacrifice. There I stand at the top of the cliff, doing joy through my chin nobly raised, you know, looking noble and every respect. And Peyman answers the disciple and gives the disciple an answer that he has not remotely expected. He says, Peyman says, when a person hears a complaining word and struggles against himself or herself and does not begin to complain in return, when a person bears an injury with patience and does not look for revenge, that is when a person lays down his or her life for the neighbor. Now, see, this is taking this huge, noble, heroic-looking principle of, you know, throw yourself in front of a train for someone. It's, anybody can do that. You know, it's when you hear gossip and you say, I'm not going to participate in this. Or someone does something to you, and you say, well, they're going to be sorry they did that to me. And no, this is not an option. No. See, it's to take these huge things down to the particular. Now, they were really, humility is about really understanding that Christian salvation, we're saved in the sight of God, we can count on heaven, so to speak. But the Christian life is made up of the small things. Now, I have a friend who is a Baptist minister, a woman, which in itself is a difficult thing at the moment. But she lived in two different Christian communities for a total of about 15 years with her husband and her children. And I asked her one time, I said, Nancy, why did you leave the communities after you've been there so long? And she said, you know, I just got absolutely sick of people coming and joining the community and wanting to stay up all night and talk about God and great, noble, spiritual things. And then she got really angry. She said, I was the only person willing to take out the garbage. Now, we sort of have this, you know, notion that spiritual things don't have to do with the everyday, or that they're so somehow high and wonderful. But this monastic material, the notion of humility, reminds us that, you know, maybe a happy marriage is made by remembering to screw on the lid of the toothpaste that drives your spouse crazy. You know, in our family, it was me learning to be the one that put the toilet paper roll up when it ran out, rather than just waiting for Richard to do it. But these small things really matter, and part of that is giving up the heroic self-image. Now, in the context of life in the church, it's got all sorts of ramifications. One of them is certainly that we don't assume that a small band of people in our congregations are going to automatically be the ones that do all the work. I mean, most congregations, you know, sort of live on the labors of a small number of people that we count on, and we encourage to feel. I mean, it suits us to encourage people to feel like they've got to take everything on themselves. But there's another thing, too. We want to talk about social justice. We get tripped up all the time, I think, by thinking, Atlanta has a huge number of homeless people. And I think every church in the city could be providing for the homeless people, and we'd still have homeless people. But the temptation for a small church is to think, well, you know, we're a small church. We don't have room for it. You know, what can we do? We're just small. We can't possibly do anything for this huge situation. It's a huge problem. Well, this notion of giving up the heroic self-image applies in churches. He's saying, if your church can only take care of three people, that's three people that won't be hungry and will be provided for. You know, you don't have to solve the whole problem. If you take care of three human beings, or one human being, you know, you're doing it. See, so this has a huge application. It's completely the opposite of what our culture tells us. This is one place where our Christian values, as we meet them in the message, stuff, go right against our culture. Because our culture is always saying, think big, think more, think, you know, more expensive. Think in terms of the big picture. You think enough in terms of the big picture, and you just are paralyzed. And you can't do anything. I said, no, we're limited. We are small. And those small things really count. They really make a difference. And when you get enough of them put together, you can make a big difference. But even if you don't make a big difference, the small things really count. So that's the first principle of the Dampa here, is of giving up the heroic self-image. Now, another odd one, that one probably makes sense to you. There's another odd part of humility, as they speak of it, and that is not quite to use their language, but this is language that is familiar to me, and that is giving up the need to be seen as above reproach. I have a friend that's out there in my car at Notre Dame whose mother did not think she should ever go dancing because the Christian should be above reproach, should avoid even the appearance of sin, you know. And actually, what she was more concerned about was the appearance than the reality. Now, the way this worked out, again, was the monastic was warned always to remember that love is the goal of Christian life. It isn't keeping the rules. Whatever the rules, it's not about keeping the rules. And there's some wonderful stories. Now, I'm going to start by giving you an impossibly difficult one. This is the one that drives my students up the wall, and I just want to say, I don't want this stuff. And this is a story involving Abba Elonius and Abba Agathon. And it's important that in this story, Agathon asks Elonius his opinion on something, and both of them are teachers. We're not talking here about a disciple asking a teacher, but both of them are teachers. So this is understood to be a serious, complex issue, and not one only of concern to beginners. But the question that Abba Agathon asked Abba Elonius was, what can I do to stop telling lies? And here's the way the reply went. Abba Elonius said to Abba Agathon, suppose two men committed murder in your presence, and one of them fled to your cell. Now, the cell was the little monastic hut. When the police coming in search of him ask you, is the murderer with you? Unless you lie, you hand him over to execution. Now, that is a clear statement. The one Abba says, I'm having trouble. Sometimes I lie and I don't know what to do. This is wrong. And rather than saying, well, there are occasions when it's not wrong, it gives an example of an occasion because he's better off lying. And in this story, a murder takes place in front of a hypothetical brother. One brother murders the other. And then the murderer runs and hides in one cell. And the police come and the murderer. And the monk is asked, have you seen the murderer? And the monk looks at the policeman and say, no. And then he's commended on that. Now, one thing to remember about the way this story works is, if the murderer were taken, picked up at that point, he would be immediately taken to the next town and executed. There would not be a trial. There would not be any, you know, this is just something that would immediately occur. There would not be any kind of explanations. And the assumption is, you don't know what happened. You know, you don't know why one murdered the other. You don't actually know anything about it. But the monk is not there to execute vengeance or justice, even. His business is love, and his business is probably to save the life of the murderer. In this case, he doesn't know what's going on. And even if he thinks he does know what's going on, the goal is love. Now, that's a tough one, you know, but it's an interesting one because it lays out baldly the sort of radicalness of some of what they were about. This is not about being above reproach. This is about love. Now, maybe we can see more about this, tell more about this, when we think of the principle that is related to it, and that is the principle that is also part of humility is of the need to give up our judgmentalism. Now, again, they are assuming, and I think probably rightly, that one of the things that most gets in the way of love is our continual practice of judgmentalism that is so indigenous to us that we don't even notice. You know, we do it so automatically, we don't even notice. It's not just a matter of looking at somebody else and saying, you're doing something you shouldn't be doing, so God knows we have trouble with that, me too. But it's a kind of continual comparison of ourselves with others that we make. Now, I always believe in giving terrible examples out of my own life. So I'm going to give you a terrible example out of my own life, which is really considered a terrible example. I've been in physical therapy for 5 weeks now for my broken ankle. And I was in a cast for 3.5 months without being able to put my foot down. Now, a pastoral counselor I know in Atlanta, I had an accident 2 weeks before I did. I fell down a hill. He fell off a ladder. And our injuries were complicated. But he got out of his cast 2 weeks before I did because his injury occurred 2 weeks before I did. And we are doing physical therapy in the same place. Well, I am sorry to have to tell you that I found myself saying to myself about 2 weeks ago, looking at Cal struggling to do this exercise, saying, I have a lot more mobility than he has. And my accident took place 2 weeks after this did. Maybe I spend more time exercising than he's doing. Now, first of all, I know that I don't spend more time exercising than he does. But even if I did spend more time, I mean, this is horrible. Here, you know, the self-satisfaction that I felt as I considered how I was doing better than my friend is horrifying. You know, I mean, this is just horrifying. This, you know, this falls within the general category of the kind of judgmentalism that we engage in. We're always measuring ourselves and our value against somebody else, you know, to see how we stand on the scale. Now, the humility is one of the pieces in humility is to train ourselves to break that pattern. And God knows that is a hard one to break. It's hard just to break the pattern of the overt judgmentalism. Now, for the overt judgmentalism, there's a wonderful saying. Let's see if I can find it for you. But if I can't, I remember it, so I'll just quote it to you. Abba Theodore said, "Do not judge the fornicator, for you yourself would then transgress the law just as much yourself. For he who said, 'Do not fornicate,' also said, 'Do not judge.'" Now, I find that extremely helpful to remember. A lot of these things I have to say to myself 3 or 4 times a day. And this is up there. But I find that incredibly useful. Now, I think one of the ways that these two things, when we fall into the trap of false humility and think that what we're called to be is selfless and to give up things, give up ourselves in order to be Christian, one of the traps that we fall into is to think that, well, if I have to do it, other people should do it. You know? And, you know, if they're not doing it, you know, then what are they doing? You situation. I remember I had to go speak in a church in Alabama a few years ago, and in a little town in Alabama. And I remember I had to take one of those planes in from Birmingham or something that holds, you know, four people, and they have to crawl in on their hands and knees, you know, and then laugh out on the floor and stack up on the table. And I came in on one of those planes, and I got to that airport, and I staggered out. I've been on the bottom of the pile. I staggered out, and I looked all around for the minister who was supposed to pick me up, and he wasn't there. And I waited, and I waited. And finally, after about 20 minutes, and there's nobody else in the airport. There didn't even seem to be anybody working in the airport. So he finally comes in about 20 minutes, puffing and puffing. And immediately, he doesn't even say, hello, you must be Roberto. But he immediately starts telling me about what a busy person he was and how all these things he had to do in his church and how he... hadn't had a vacation that year, and then in fact he hadn't had a vacation for the last 17 years. And so at this point I squeeze in, oh, that's terrible. Yeah. And he said, my contribution is, you know, meanwhile we're now driving through the Alabama countryside and have been for, you know, 20 minutes. And he says, yes, we were going to last year. My wife and I arranged to go away. We had our bags all packed, and we were getting ready to drive to the airport. And a lady in my congregation called, and she was having elective surgery, and she said she just couldn't do it unless I was there with her. And so we just had to cancel our plans at the last minute. And I thought, if I were having surgery, this is the last person. No, it's all right. I don't mind missing the only vacation that I would have had in 16 years if it weren't for you. It's funny, and yet it's true, you know, that this is one of the reasons, you know, when we try to give ourselves away and think that's humility, it doesn't work because we don't belong to ourselves. We belong to God. We cannot give ourselves away because God has given ourselves to us to love. And we can't love without a self. It takes a self to do the loving. And when we get caught in the trap of judgmentalism, it's often because we think that our self really does come from what we do and how we look and what we know. But our self doesn't come from those places. Our self comes from God, who has given ourselves to us. And it's that self out of which we go. We cannot pour ourselves out like water into sand. It does not burst. If we try not to have a self in that way, we get it from someplace else that's not good for us or for other people. We can't do without a self. So instead of ourselves being grounded in God, then our self becomes grounded in our vision of ourselves as a righteous person or a perfect person or whatever, a person who owns five cars or maybe a person who owns one car, you know, but it's a trap there, so that this judging thing is not simply something that stands on its own. It's part of this whole conglomerate, which we call humility. Now, let me say one more thing about this before we just open this up for conversation. And that is that with this old view of humility, this false view of humility, there's a certain kind of power in it, but it's the power of manipulation. It's the power of, if I get the last brownie, if you take the last brownie, I decide on the new. You know, and a lot of family life in the South is actually based on this sort of path. You know, I don't know, maybe, probably not like that in the Northwest. especially as I said, spouses and children and their mothers. You know, this needs to be more of a dynamic with mothers and children and children. So there's a kind of power, but it's a kind of underhanded, manipulative power. A power that's not good for anybody who participates in. Now, this real humility is genuine and powerful. The claim that they're making is that real humility is genuinely powerful. Now, let me read you one of my favorite quotes. In fact, I'll read you a couple of quotes. Abba John the Dwarf said, talking to his disciples, he's testing them, giving them a little quiz. Who sold Joseph into Egypt out of the pit? You remember that story? A brother replied, saying, it was his brothers. No, the old man said to him, it was his humility. Because he could have said, I'm their brother, and I'm objective. But because he kept silent, he sold himself by his humility. It is also his humility which set him up as chief in Egypt. The claim is that if you can live this out, humility is the virtue of a strong person. And it has radical results in life and the people that it touches. Now, let me read you another story, a little bit longer than these things. They said of Abba Macarius the Egyptian that one day he went up from Scetus to the mountain of Nitria. Those were two of the monastic centers. As he approached the place, and the mountain was a rugged and hard place to reach. As he approached the place, he told his disciple to go on ahead. On the road, the disciple met a priest of the pagans. The brother shouted after him, saying, Oh, devil, where are you off to? The priest turned back and beat him and left him half dead. Then, picking up his stick, the pagan fled. When that pagan priest had gone a little further, Abba Macarius met him running and said to him, Greetings, you weary man. Quite astonished, the other came up to him and said, What good do you see in me that you greet me this way? The old man said to him, I've seen you wearing yourself out without knowing that you were wearing yourself out in vain. The other said to him, I will not let you go till you've made me a monk. And then comes the moral of the story. Through him, many pagans became Christians. So Abba Macarius said, one evil word makes even the good evil, while one good word makes even the evil good. Now, that's again a story of the power of humility. Macarius, what we would think of as an appropriate response to this beating was from Macarius to say, nobody treats my disciple like that. You're going to be sorry, and then zap him. That's what we would expect. But Macarius responds in exactly an opposite way. Instead of accusing him, he looks at him and he says, boy, you really look tired. And from that place in the conversation, he gives up his judgmental listen. Macarius gives up any sort of heroic notion of fixing the situation. And as the last line is, through him, many pagans became Christian. So this was understood to be powerful. And as I said last night and the night before, for you all who were not here, these ancient monastics were, in fact, incredibly powerful people within their own culture. Even though they're outliving the Egyptian desert, the world comes to them. And they are giving advice to emperors, to landowners, to pagans, to people having trouble with their children, to married folk. And they stood absolutely at the center of the imagination of their own culture. So they, in fact, were extremely powerful people. And a good bit of that was through the power of humility they tried to embody. Now, we have about 10 minutes for questions, comments, complaints.
Meredith, throughout this, the underlying theme, I'm not sure you were explicit about it, is love of self.
That's right.
And self-acceptance, just as I am today. I mean, you did talk some about it. But none of this is possible without that.
That's right.
We're terrible at that in this culture.
That's right.
We're awful.
That's right. And we tend to think, we get caught in the dynamic, that we've gotten the notion that a good person is to be selfless. And then we catch on and say, that doesn't work. That's terrible. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to claim myself. And then we forget, as Christians, that self-love and love of neighbor and love of God make a triangle. And you can't have one without the other. So we go flip it all the way over in the other direction and say, I'm not even going to think about anybody except myself. Because I know that stuff doesn't work. But this is offering a third alternative to this. So love of self and love of God. Let me tell you, there's a letter of Anthony where he talks about this. Just one little line. Let me find it. Well, I actually got a couple of quotes for you from Anthony. Well, let me start with this one. Let's see. Here we go. Not exactly the quote that I wanted, but this will be the trick. This is from a letter of that Anthony wrote to male and female monks in our synagogue in Israel. He says, the person who sins against the neighbor does evil to the self. And the person who does good to the neighbor does good to the self. Otherwise, who is able to do ill to God, or who is there who could hurt God, or who would ever serve God or exalt God as God deserves? Therefore, while we are still clothed in this heavy body, let us rouse up the image of God in ourselves by incitement of each other and deliver ourselves to death for our souls and for each other. And if we do this, we will be manifesting the substance of God's compassion for us. Yeah, that's what that is. Here's another quote from a different letter. Actually, it's the same letter, sorry. God has gathered us Christians out of all regions, so God should make resurrection of our hearts from the earth and teach us that we are all of one substance and members of one another. Now, here's the key sentence. Therefore, or reading into the key sentence, we ought greatly to love one another. For one who loves one's neighbor loves God, and the one who loves God loves his or her own soul. The love of God and love of self and love of neighbor are connected in such a way that you can't do without one of them. You just can't do without one of them. If you try to do without the love of self, what you end up with is a person like the minister in Alabama, you know, that I was talking about. And I hold him up not as an oddity, but as a person that we all are inclined to be like. You know, he's an example of someone that we all are tempted. I think, you know, if I can give up enough, then I will be a lover of God and human beings. But you damn well better be doing it yourself. I'm giving it up. You know, don't expect me to give it up once you're doing it. You know, you owe me something because I'm doing it. See, and that's, can't have love of neighbor and love of God without also a proper love of self. And the love of self is expressed in terms of understanding that we're people made to love and that we are in relationship. We are made, love is natural to human beings. Not loving is something that brings us out of shape. Now, I saw another hand.
Yes, well, I'm interested in how the social context shapes us in a slightly different way than what we have. You've made reference to this woman, the only one to take out the garbage in that Christian community. We also know that these monastics, like Anthony, left. And and I suppose part of my response to him, I don't know whether it's self-defense or what, but is, well, yeah, of course, if you're out there in the desert and everybody's doing this, it would be easier. But how do you do that in the midst of all the institutions of which we are a part, where these are not common goals? Or at least they're not common public goals. Mm-hmm. It may be that many people in those institutions share those goals privately, mm-hmm. but not as a corporate body. Mm-hmm. And that's my struggle. So what do they say to those of us who haven't gone out into the desert and are contending with those other powers?
And that's a really tough one. And it really takes a complicated or a long answer, but I'll try to give a long answer in short, shorthand sort of terms. First of all, the monastic teachers did not think that you had to go out to do this. And there are two or three stories in the sayings where a teacher prays and asks God to show him the person in the world who is closest to the goal of love. And in each case, it's a lay person in the world. In one case, it's a couple. So clearly, they didn't think that you had to do this. They thought for themselves they needed to do this if they were going to work it out. Now, another part of that is living in community in the desert. We've got some sisters here in our group here, and they will be glad to tell you that living in community sounds more ideal than it actually works out. The struggles are tough ones living in community, whether you're doing it in the desert or you're doing it in Seattle or Atlanta. That in fact, even though you would assume everybody's got the same goals, it turns out that everybody doesn't have the same goals. Or they may have the same goals, but they have some different things that get in the way of that. So that's one part of it. That's one part of the answer. I think another part of the answer is that, it may be hard to live this out when you have to keep it private in a job where you're assuming that people have got different swimming goals. Now, I teach in a seminary, and people have got very different goals than that. But part of my job, I figure, is to remind people, hey, we're a seminary. We're training people for ministry. As far as I'm concerned, we should be trying to live as an eschatological community. Now, that's tough to say that. People don't like it when you say that. Even when you sort of put it in the open terms. Well, I feel called to say it, So all of us have at least one part of our lives where we do need to remind ourselves as a group. Most of us don't remember this even in our churches. And we need to remember in our churches. That's the place that we, maybe we should stop worrying about doing it in the workplace and try to just, work it out to begin with. This is a good example of a place to let go of the heroic self-interest and say, well, I can't do it in this larger world picture, but I can do it in my family life. I can't do it very well in my family life, but it's really worth trying it anyway. Rather than think of the whole transformation of the whole world right off the bat, to start from there, but to think of it as something you move toward, that the small steps count. Now, I don't know if that sounds like an answer to your question. It's really tough, though. I know that this is a tough
thing. I think partly what I'm pushing on is that the not even the rewards in most of our workplaces, but the rules.
Mm-hmm.
The rules of engagement mm-hmm. are such that not even if you want to succeed, but just if you want to keep playing.
Keep your job.
You just want to keep playing. Uh-huh. It's contradictory.
Uh-huh. And I have suffered a lot from that over the years. And a lot of it, I think I finally, part of my own growth, attempt to grow in love, is to sort out the difference between my pride and, you know, my hurt pride. Mm-hmm. And sort of say, what is most valuable to me? And I've got to be willing to pay the price for what's most valuable. And part of the thing is, I like to look good, you know, and I like people to think I'm a nice person. And I like people to think I'm a good person. And it's hard for me to know that people wouldn't think that, you know, or that I'm violating the rules. So part of my discipline is to learn how to violate the rules and say, if people don't think I'm being a good person, I've got to live with that. And that's really tough. You know, that's mm-hmm. not as tough for some people as others. But it's been tough for me over the years. And I think most women have been trained, surely in the South, to be nice. You know,
and they have PR to like them. I think they're good, you know.
It's only in the... It's only in the...
Yeah.
Okay, well, it's time for us to quit, folks.